Check this out.
It is time.
Check it out, y'all.
You are now about to witness.
And it goes a little something like this.
Alexander Ovechkin curl and drag to the back end. He scores! Simply sensational! Brodeur looking for the goal. Down the ice. Score! Martin Brodeur!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to another edition of the Game Time Decision Podcast. I'm your host, Colton Prale. It's another edition of our analytics series. Joining me today, it's Ryan Stimson. Ryan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you on. You have been mentioned in, I think, just about every episode so far. So clearly you're doing some work that is really, really valuable to the community. And I am excited to get into this. This was when I was putting together this series. The work that you do was one of the key parts of it that, and in my mind, this was something we couldn't leave out, and that is tracking and especially passing. Those are just two very key components in the future of where analytics are heading, so I am excited to get into those, but let's get right into it. I open each of these series with the first question. It goes to everyone. It's just, where have we been in hockey analytics? Where are we now, and where are we going? Just for new listeners to kind of get a grasp on the state of hockey analytics.
Well, yeah, I think, as far as where have we been, and some of your previous guests, you know, have talked about this at length a little bit, so, you know, I won't harp too much on it, but basically it's just, looking at, shot metrics, you know, the team and player level, and that they're more predictive of future goals than, your current goal rate. So, basically it was just a shift in terms of what metrics to look at. Where we are now, I feel like we've done a pretty good job investigating a lot of things. There are certain, things that previously we ascribed a lot of importance to, like zone starts for one, that through work of people like Matt Cain and Michael Blake McCurdy, they have kind of dispelled that notion that they have a large impact on player performance. Some other things, we still really haven't agreed upon ideal ways to quantify quality competition, quality of teammates, things like that. So there's still certainly work to be done, but I feel like we're much more confident now in the public sphere of how we, can evaluate players, evaluate teams, measure results, whether they're for real or not, or they're, runs of, luck or, unsustainable percentages. Where we go from here, I feel... it's kind of similar to work like I've been doing, similar like work to like Corey Schneider's been doing. It's really just about getting data, because what we have right now is we have a good way to evaluate players and teams, but we don't have a good way to tell a coach or general manager. It's one thing to acquire a good player that the analytics community think is a good player, but it's another thing entirely to, this is what you do to improve your team metric. Like, this is what you do to improve your shot metrics, to improve your shot quality, to improve how a couple players might play together. And I think you need ice level, actionable data points like we're collecting to then quantify and test and measure to inform smarter ways to simply go about playing hockey or customizing your lineup. So where are we going? I think it's just going to be more and more of that.
That's a great answer and very unique compared to some of the other answers we've had so far. And that's why I was excited to have you on. Tell us a little bit about the passing project in general. What is the idea behind it? How to get started? And for those who are unaware, what is it?
I guess I'll start with what it is. It's just over the last 3-4 seasons, it started in 2013-2014, really just quantifying that other half of how teams generate offense. We know that, players have to shoot, teams have to generate offense, but, who were these facilitators in offense? Which players were maybe going unnoticed? Where was their value that could be had? And how it started is, I'm kind of getting old by, online hockey Twitter standards now, but it was like summer of 2013, I was reading, because I followed a lot of, I'm a big soccer fan, and I was following a lot of soccer analytics talk, and there's a book out there, Soccernomics, that I read, and there's a section where they deal with data collection and different data points in soccer that teams use to evaluate. And there was one section where they were interviewing Gavin Fleek, who is the head of the performance and analysts at Manchester City, and he talked about, well, if you looked at the completion percentage, you know, in the final third of the pitch, teams that did well there, you could basically line up the teams that did well, and it would match the standings. And so I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And, we didn't have anything for hockey, so, I was going to watch all the Devils games anyway, and I figured I might as well just enter a few ticks into a spreadsheet and see what comes out the other end. And it's kind of just become this huge thing, and, really just kind of came out of, a question is what are we missing? What are we not accounting for?
That's if you haven't read it and you're a soccer fan, that's a phenomenal book that's worth checking out. Now, you've been doing this for a little while, and I've got a decent set of data for the Devils and from around the league. In theory, this project should confirm ideas that in some part hold true. It's worth it to move the goalie. You should pass on a 2-on-1 if it's open, stuff like that. What do you think are some of the other revelations that are going to come from your project that maybe people haven't thought of so far, or, just thought about it but never really related that idea to passing?
Well, I think the idea, and actually I wrote an article maybe just about a year ago now, looking at, a player, they're, we talk a lot about like primary points as, the goals a player scores or the primary assists that player has. So what I did is I looked at our passing data and, players' own individual shots that the NHL provides, and, married the two together and simply looked at, these are the players, I called the metric primary shot contributions, which is a player's shots and their shot assists. And, within the sample we had, which was, I think like 75 players from their full season, or 75 forwards from, the full season that we had on them, looking at how those rates of production accumulated and how they predicted how many points they would score over the rest of the season, similar to what we found with shot metrics predicting goals at the team level, it was the same thing for individual point production. Is these events accumulate quicker, and they give you a stronger signal as far as predicting how well that player will perform over the course of the season. And I think that's a unique way to go about assessing player performance, because then you can, if I'm a GM and I see this and I have this data available, I'll be able to go out and get talent that's not, being priced appropriately on the market. Look at, I think of the Islanders waiving P.A. Parenteau and just giving away for free. Christopher Stieg, who went unclaimed all year or last summer, didn't have a contract, couldn't get a deal in Europe, some insurance thing, and goes to Edmonton on a practice, no contract, and then Calgary snags him from him. It's like it took that long for a player who was one of the best at setting up shots for teammates last season. And, things like this tell us that GMs and teams still don't evaluate players properly. And, that's not news to anybody. So.
No, it's not. And that's part of the reason I am doing this series, is to show people how you can evaluate players and what are the correct ways and then the more efficient ways to do it. And I was going to ask you if there was a player that you thought that people were undervaluing. I mean, Joe Thornton is obviously the gold standard at something like this, at creating shot attempts. But yeah, you've nailed it with Christopher Stieg. And that's a player that didn't get a lot of love, but has seen sustained success just about everywhere he's played. And it's confusing to me why players like that, or I look at Elise Stempniak as another one, just don't seem to get what I feel is the love they deserve. And I'm curious if those numbers also show up in your tracking projects.
Yeah, I mean, you can find lots of valuable players for those kind of players, and then you can also look at things at the team level. I've started to get into this. I think I wrote like a piece last summer when I started kind of this line of analysis, is looking at the data at the team level and testing different passing sequences, like where they originate, where they go to, you know, how well teams or how many of those teams generate, and then simply looking at, you know, in the analysis, you know, how well do these, or what's the relationship these kind of sequences have on, you know, future scoring. And, you know, at the team level, obviously, you know, a lot of this comes with, you know, small sample size warning. You know, we only have like, you know, like 40 games, 30, 40 games on average for teams for last season. But, you know, a lot of this exploratory analysis, you look for things that, one, make sense to you and, you know, pass the smell test. And the other thing is, you know, is there some signal here that maybe we should explore and analyze further? And I think that opens up a lot of interesting ways of, okay, like this series of passes, you know, for example, I wrote an article last summer on, you know, shot assists from below the icing line when you're offensive zone. And, you know, those, you know, within the sample we had a, you know, relationship to how well teams scored. And, you know, so, okay, that kind of makes sense qualitatively and quantitatively now. So how do you then reevaluate your team's offense? Like, if you're struggling to score goals, you know, what can we do to possibly generate a few more of these chances? And so I think it just opens up, you know, for a lot of different ways to analyze, evaluate players and analyze team tactics.
It's funny that you bring that up, because I was just about to as well. Earlier in this series, I think it was episode 3 with Rachel, her and I were talking about Joe Thornton and his play behind the net and the efficiency of his passing from below the goal line, specifically on the power play. And I wanted to get your opinion on that, not necessarily just how good he is from below the goal line, but if passes from the below the goal line appear to be, at least from your cursory research, more dangerous than East-West, if you think that's going to affect the way power plays start deploying, you know, that fifth man, if instead of being in front of the net, maybe he moves down low, we're going to see more strong side plays so that you get more players underneath the goal line. Do you think this research is going to affect tactics within, you know, the next season or two?
I mean, I think it already has to some extent. I think it's only going to grow as, you know, more and more, you know, data is collected, more and more research is done. You know, we're sitting at last season, you know, we just crossed the 600 game mark. You know, Corey Schneider is tracking this entire season, so, you know, hopefully we'll be able to combine those, you know, to look at, you know, these and see what it entails. But you know, you mentioned on the power play, like, you know, instead of playing in front of the net, you know, you have that guy maybe pop out, play below the goal line, on either side or behind the net itself. And I think, you know, specifically to power plays, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, as good as some teams' power plays are, I think they're incredibly static a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, players, you know, they have their, you know, their roles on the power play, and I understand, you know, you want structured, you know, plays, you know, certain handedness in certain sides of the ice and situations. It makes sense. But I also think you do limit yourself if you, you know, confine those players to those areas. I think it leaves out, you know, because the hardest thing for the defenses to do is to, you know, have players moving behind them. You know, so if you're looking left, the puck's over here, and but you know players are over there behind you, relatively in the same spot, it's not as difficult as if you have, you know, D coming down, you know, through the, like, a mid-lane drive or something, and a forward popping back up top, and it just creates a little confusion. So I think if players were to pop out, you know, below a goal line like that in certain situations, it forces them to, you know, expand kind of the angle, you know, the field of vision that they have to consider on the ice, they have to survey. So yeah, I would agree with, you know, Rachel's comments that, you know, that's certainly something that more teams can do more of.
Have you found a sequence of passing that seems to be more, or that leads to, I guess, more goals than others?
Well, I mean, we have, you know, I've calculated, like, shooting percentages on, you know, the various permutations that we have, and, you know, you see, you know, things rise, excuse me, like, in the offensive zone, you know, shooting percentage from a shot that isn't preceded by a pass to one that's preceded by one, to one that's preceded by at least two, you know, shooting percentage will rise on those sequences, which makes sense because you think if a team in the offensive zone is moving the puck well and completing at least two passes, you know, the defense is moving, it's readjusting, the goalie's moving and, you know, presumably has to locate the new puck, the new shooter. And that's a lot of information to process, especially if the puck's moving quickly. So that's something for sure. You know, we look at, obviously we talked about passes from below the goal line. You know, we look at Royal Road passes, passes back to the point, those kind of things. One-timers in general, which really I'm surprised, like, one-timers isn't kept, like, those shots aren't tabulated by the league. You know, you have your slap shots, but obviously there's a difference between a slap shot and a one-timer. And, you know, just one-timers themselves, you know, have a much higher shooting percentage than most other shot types. So, you know, if that's something I haven't spent a whole lot of time looking at, but, you know, it's just on the list. I have a, you know, really long list of what to get into with this data. And, you know, is there a certain measure of repeatability? Is there a talent to set up one-timers, to receive passes and, you know, attempt one-timers? And so, you know, that I think, especially we talked about the power play, you know, that could be something that might you look at to establish, you know, this player is really good, this is a definite skill, so we want to probably pair up our best one-timer versus our best setup, you know, passer of setup or one-timers. And, you know, it's just something to fine-tune those percentages. You know, because obviously when you get into this data at this level, there's a lot of fine margins both ways, but if you can just increase a few things throughout your lineup, a few percentage points, you know, that has a you know, cascading effect through over the course of a season.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, you mentioned you're a big soccer fan. What's interesting to me is they've got a couple big proponents that have expected goals models that rely heavily and involve passing plays, and that influences the weight of the shot. There's a lot of arguments for using those in that that sphere as well. So I'm interested to see if hockey moves that way. I think it will eventually once we've got camera tracking, because it clearly affects how often you're going to score. You've moved on though a bit from this passing project, and you've started what you called the forechecking project, as opposed to there on hockey graphs that you detailed kind of what it was about. What was the decision, or what was the rationale behind the decision to start tracking really more of the offense?
Well, it was over the summer. You know, Corey Schneider was doing a lot of these great posts on last year's playoffs, you know, digging into, you know, the stats on each playoff series. And at some point throughout the playoff series that he was working on, he reached out to me and, you know, wanted to ask some questions about, you know, just basically how I was tracking everything, how we were, how all the volunteers that work with me were going about doing this. So I sent him, you know, our sheets and everything and our guidelines, and he incorporated into what he was doing in the playoffs and said that he was going to do it this season. So I was like, okay, well, there's no reason for us to, you know, duplicate all of that work. So, you know, we've just progressively continued to work on last season to add to those totals. And that kind of left me with like, okay, well, what are we going to do? And so I sort of got this idea in my head, you know, let's look at, you know, different forechecks or, you know, different ways teams pressure, and then on the flip side of that you'll also get breakout data. And so let's look at different breakout plays. And this really became about after about like 25 emails between myself and Prashant Tyre and Charlie O'Connor, you know, a couple other writers over at Hockey Graphs, Winging It Motown, and Broad Street Hockey, and then Alex Novit. You know, we were kind of kicking around this idea and our guidelines and what to do, and yeah, we just kind of launched right into it. You know, it's still, you know, really small samples of data with what we have, because, you know, tracking takes a while and I haven't been able to spend as much time on it as I want to with other stuff going on. But, you know, through some preliminary, you know, analysis on, you know, some Devils games from the season, there's been some interesting things to look at as far as, you know, what is the, you know, because a lot of hockey coaches and people, they're so, you know, averse to taking risks, right? And you see that a lot in coaching in general. You know, look at the NFL and how many coaches punt on like 4th and 2 from the 50-yard line, and you know, it just makes you want to rip your hair out. And so when you have coaches, you know, forechecking with like one player, you know, defensemen just way back already at your own blue line, like just giving up, you know, all this space, it's like, oh, well, we want to try to break up the entry. Well, it's like, you can break up the entry by pressuring them on the forecheck and getting the puck back so they don't even make an entry attempt. You know, it's like, it's just, it's not, it's, there's not enough forward thinking in terms of strategy. And, you know, one of the things we're looking at is when you forecheck with one, two, three forecheckers, which we just call, like, we just have like a qualifier for how aggressive a forecheck is, which is the number of players below the faceoff dots pressuring the opponent. Okay. And like, when you do that, like, how often are you giving up an entry the other way? And there's really not a huge degree or huge range of variance in, like, it's not like if you forecheck with three people in an aggressive fashion that you're giving up just a ton of controlled entries the other way. And obviously the rate at which you generate shots and force turnovers increases significantly. So what is the actual, you know, what's the mathematical trade-off to that? Like, what's the added expected value of, I will generate so many shots per player on the forecheck while also keeping in mind of, this is how many shots I can expect to give up due to how many entries I'll give up and the type of entry. And so you can kind of, similar, very similar to what Eric Tulsky did with zone entries. And if you can just assign a value to those events, then I think that gives you a platform to really investigate forechecking and breakout tactics.
What I hear you saying is almost advocating for a type of high press, to use a soccer term, in hockey. And if you want a real world example of how that can work, you look at the EPL, you look at a team like Liverpool, who have fantastic offense, one of the highest expected goals for in the league. They give up the most big chances, but overall defensively, they're about average because they are so strong defensively. And from what you're seeing in your numbers, it suggests that that sort of translates to hockey as well. If you're aggressive and you're quick on the forecheck, you can out offense your defense. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously, you know, have a long way to go to proving it in certain mathematics.
Yeah, nothing's concrete yet.
But I mean, the issue there is, you mentioned Liverpool, and like, I'm actually a Liverpool fan, and so like Jurgen Klopp, you know, his pressure, you know, depends solely on, you know, the fluidity of his team and people, you know, pressing, you know, filling in for each other on their press. Like, if one person doesn't do their job, a gap opens up, the whole thing breaks down. In hockey, you have this mindset that, you know, your forwards forecheck and your defenders stay back. And so it's much easier to beat presses in hockey if D aren't activating. Right, so
yeah,
because one of the other things we're tracking is, you know, how effective is a forecheck when a defenseman jumps in, when a defenseman activates, whether it's just, you know, coming down the wall in a pinch to try to keep the puck in, whether it's themselves, I don't know, just coming down center ice to try to pick up a pass or what have you, right? If they're not standing on the blue line or out of the zone entirely, you know, how effective are you? And really through like our preliminary data, like, when teams do that, like, they don't really give up many rushes. I mean, sure, people will always remember that bad pinch somebody makes that leads to like a 2-on-1 the other way. And so that's a reason why people say, oh, don't do that. Well, it's like, no, that's completely wrong. So, you know, if teams, if they, you know, can press more with their defensemen, and actually you saw a little bit of the Czech team do this against Canada in the World Junior semis. Was it the semis they played?
Quarters, I think.
Quarters, yeah, quarter final, my bad. It really all happens like when I go to bed because I have a 2-year-old, so I always just watch highlights the next day. But I actually found the Czech-Canada game on YouTube. Someone sent me a link. And like, they, like, the Czechs were doing something really, really well that they would kind of like set up to take away like half the ice, whatever the puck was on. And like, they so that kind of like helped squeeze play, and you had such close support with them for a while that really gave Canada, you know, some trouble in the early going. Obviously, you know, the game opened up tremendously and they were kind of forced to abandon that, but there was some interesting things going on with the Czechs in that game that not a lot of teams, you know, I think that they don't do currently, I think they would certainly benefit from doing.
How do you think this kind of research is going to impact more offensive defensemen, players like a Duncan Keith or an Erik Karlsson or a PK Subban, who I think would be very strong pressers? They've got the speed, they've got the hockey IQ, and their real strength is in their offense. Do you think if these systems were implemented, it would change, one, our perception of the role of defensemen, and two, our perception of their defensive abilities?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to change eventually. Like, I think that's one of the big things holding innovation back in hockey. I mean, you look at the different systems teams use across the league, and I mean, there's not a whole lot of variation for most teams. You know, a couple teams might try a few more creative things simply because maybe they have the talent and they feel okay to do that. Or, you know, maybe they have an all-world goaltender and they're like, well, you know, they'll bail us out a couple times, you know, so maybe we can do this and we can push forward and press. But yeah, I think there needs to be, you know, because obviously there's some defensemen are not certainly created equal. And there's an incredible just different mindset with how that position should be deployed, should be coached, those players should be developed, and, you know, what their role is. And I think, you know, you'll see more of, you know, defensemen either leading the rush or leading, you know, like a neutral zone counter, like through the neutral zone, you know, and they'll be one of the first players maybe in the other zone creating havoc, and you have, you know, one defenseman back, and that's okay to do if you have the puck and you, you know, taking advantage, that extra player, you know, will open up space for your other forwards to, you know, get the puck into the zone. And, you know, as far as like Subban, Keith, Karlsson, those kind of players you mentioned, if they are not, I feel like if you're not coaching them or letting them be aggressive and, you know, press the opposition, then I think it is kind of a waste of some of their talents. You know, any coach, and this is another thing about hockey and how we evaluate players, that defensively, and you see this show up in DTM about Hart, his war metric, and how the top war players, it's dominated by forwards. And that's, I think, because, you know, defensemen can't contribute as much simply because of the nature of their role, offensively, that is. And defensively, there's so much system and team impact into that that, you know, like a coach can tell them anywhere where to stand, right? Like, here, you know, if the puck goes here, you responsible for, like, this quadrant. If your man goes here, you slide over here. And, you know, as long as the team has a good structure, like, defensively, they'll be okay. But it's when they go forward that you really, you know, defensemen really separate themselves from the rest of the pack. And, you know, I think eventually, you know, some coach somewhere is going to innovate that or rebrand some of the positioning and adopt, you know, things maybe from it, like a, you know, like the Swedish torpedo system or some other type of creative outlet that kind of redefines the traditional roles that we have for positions.
I'm with you. I think once we can get out of the idea that a defenseman is only useful in his own zone, or that's where most of his work is, we can move past and we can start exploring new ways to play the game. And that's, I think, the biggest thing is going to come from, you know, the metrics that you and Corey are helping to create and work on, is just rethinking hockey as a whole. Quickly here, some of the other work you've done is in the NCAA, which, one, I think is really interesting because there's not a lot of stuff being done there. But two, when I talked with Ian in our first episode, he was saying how he wishes there was more stats and availability, really, for junior numbers. Do you find you have the same issue working in the NCAA, and how do you think college can improve its accessibility?
Well, I mean, I think the NCAA, I don't think it would be a lot more work for them to simply, you know, have their game trackers record a few more, you know, data points. You know, just record, you know, they don't have to record who's on the ice for everything like the NHL does, but, you know, just if they simply record who's on the ice for all the shots, I mean, I think that would give you a tremendous amount of new data to start analyzing, you know, those games. And, you know, some of the work I've done, I wrote a few articles last year, and I'll probably do another one, you know, as the season winds down to a close, like updating information. It's just really looking at what can we use from the existing data to kind of estimate, you know, player performance. And this kind of builds off of work like Eric Tulsky did and like Jonathan Willis and a couple others, you know, years ago, just looking at, you know, estimating time on ice, estimating quality competition, quality teammates. And then, you know, I kind of started to take it a little further a couple months ago is, okay, knowing the context, right, knowing a little bit more about the environment a player plays in, you know, the quality of competition, forwards and defensemen, same thing, quality to me. And that's actually a quick side note. I think that that's, you absolutely have to split quality competition and teammates by position. I wrote a long article about it, but I think you absolutely have to do it. If you don't do that, I think you're kind of missing the boat on what those can tell you. But back to what I was saying, if you know those things, and then you know how the teams performed offensively and defensively, then I think you can kind of set up to estimate and kind of predict, okay, this is what we would expect this player's shot numbers to look like. So that's some research I'm doing. I have, you know, you need actual data to test this on. I have two seasons of full player shot differentials game by game from last season. I actually just spoke to someone, does some work for an NCAA team today, actually, who's getting me some other data. And I'll have, so I'll have at least like four seasons of data by the end of this season to, or maybe four or five maybe, to kind of help train that model and those, you know, regressions to see how accurate we can make this. Because I think if you can do that, I think that saves a lot of people time, you know, from having to track things on their team themselves, because then you can then take that, and this is another thing for NCAA, you know, they can't sign free agents, they can't make trades, right? So they have to just scout and recruit. So if you can then use those same methodologies, you can use it to apply it to the league, the feeder leagues that you scout from, and that gives you even a little bit better idea of who you're bringing into your program and how they might perform. So unfortunately, you know, with no data, no good data, really you have to rely on estimates, but I think even some of those methods can give you a leg up on your competition.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, you see it with the teams who are, you know, fairly invested into analytics in the NHL. You know, you got Toronto, you got Carolina, and you look at the draft picks they're accruing and the value of those draft picks. Sean Tierney, we had him on a couple episodes. He was putting out some really interesting visualizations about that. And it's not surprising to see teams trying to invest in an area they think they can exploit to gain an edge up on an opponent's. So, you know, making its way into the NCAA would be even more apparent which teams are investing into that sort of knowledge. Quickly here, you kind of touched on it there a bit, but what's next for you with your tracking, with your projects? What are you hoping to get accomplished in 2017?
Well, I won't get nearly as much accomplished as I'd like to in 2017. That just is always the case. No, I'm actually right now, I am working on compiling a lot of our passing data for the last 2 years, making it available, you know, both is like individual player events, you know, like the rate at which, you know, player assists on shots, generates a, you know, entry assist, or, you know, how often they get open for a one-timer or something like that. As well as on-ice events, like how often is a player, so are there certain defensemen that are on the ice for, you know, odd man rushes more than the other? And so really I'm just working on compiling all of that information, and then I'll put it out there so people can look at it. So we have a reference, because, you know, if we have data for the last two seasons, and then Corey comes out with a third year of data, then, you know, we can certainly look at trends. You know, we can certainly look at things in the public of, you know, how well this player does something or not. So one of the things, because I always like to, you know, make our stuff available, I always make the raw data available. That's obviously harder to navigate for some people, and you know, putting it, a lot of people have asked for stuff like this, so I'm going to do that. What else, you know, continue to look at the forechecking data as that comes in. You know, I wrote a piece maybe like 3-4 weeks ago now, looking at trying to quantify like what we see in breakout data. Like, for example, you know, mm-hmm. like, and this is the other thing. This kind of ties in my interest in NCAA as well. Is, you know, NCAA, your players are your players. So you're constantly, how do we refine our tactics? How do we get better? What do we need to do? And so this piece I looked at in our breakout data for the Devils is, okay, what, you know, what sorts of things correlate with, you know, how do we know we're doing well in our defensive zone? Well, if we break out with possession, we see, you know, an inverse relationship with the shots we give up. You know, if we don't break out with possession, you know, we're dumping the puck out, it's coming right back in, we're turning the puck over. So it makes sense, right? If you get out of your zone with possession, with the puck, you're going to face fewer shots. That's just logical. I think anybody who's watched hockey sees that happen. So, okay, we know those are good. We know we want to break out of our zone with possession. How do we make that happen? So through some of the tracking we've been doing is looking at breakout plays. And, you know, like your typical breakout plays, like your ups, your over, your wheel, you know, you rim it around the boards, you reverse it. You know, these kind of general basic plays that anyone who, you know, has watched hockey or played beer league knows what they are, you know. So, and basically looking at the different plays, I found, you know, again, this is early small sample stuff, but looking at the relationship of the rate at which teams attempt to reverse the puck or send a pass over on their breakout has a strong correlation with how often they break out of the zone with possession. And I think it makes sense because if you watch games, if you see a team or player like kind of reverse course, the other team's forecheck will simply kind of flow by them a lot of the time. And, you know, how often do you see a player grab the puck and then just blindly throw it up the boards, or he's skating the same direction the forecheck is going? You know, it's kind of like it's where they want them to go with the puck, so it comes up, and then it's a 50-50 puck battle, and sometimes it comes right back down. So, you know, and again, it goes back to what we talked about earlier. If you find something interesting that measures out and then also passes your smell test, passes the eye test, and then it makes just sense makes sense tactically, well, it's okay. That's something you can then take to a coach and say, hey, look, this is what we want to do. This is where we want to go with our breakout. And this is a roadmap to get there.
And that was a fantastic piece, by the way. I loved the GIFs that you used in that. I'll link to it down in the description below. It was phenomenal. If you haven't read it, it'll be linked. You definitely need to go and do that as soon as possible. Honestly, it is worth your time. It's very informative. It is easy to understand. It isn't even math heavy. There's really no reason why you shouldn't be reading Ryan's pieces. You can find all of his stuff actually at hockey-graphs.com. You can follow him on Twitter, RK_Stimp, and you can listen to his own hockey podcast. Search Another Hockey Podcast on SoundCloud and on Twitter. It's funny. It is out there. It is always entertaining. I really can't give you enough praise for that one. Always a good listen.
Well, good. I'm glad. Yeah, we haven't recorded one in a while. In the holidays, it's, you know, Asma's been overseas somewhere, and it's just tough to find time around the holidays, and whatnot. So, but we'll get back up hopefully soon.
Go give them a listen, subscribe, give them a like, give them a rating on iTunes. Do the same for this as well. We appreciate it when you do. It makes us happy, gets us noticed. Thanks for listening, Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been so incredibly informative.
Well, thanks. Yeah, anytime. Appreciate it.
All right. If you like this episode, you can check out all of our past episodes on iTunes, on SoundCloud, on lastwordonhockey.com. You can check me out on Twitter at Colton Prale. You can follow the podcast at GTD_podcast. Got another episode coming out next Wednesday, and a regular one comes out on Mondays and Tuesdays as well. Until next week, have a good one.